make sure that you're listening to the right people in terms of advice. I'm not going to learn about, you know, SEC regulations from someone that's not an attorney.
For sure. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm not going to learn how to, you know, fight MMA and train from someone that's never done it before, yeah. You know? So I think in all reality, it's a lot of common sense stuff, and it's not more complicated than it needs to be.
Welcome to the Rich Summers Report, where we talk real estate, business, and wealth building, all while keeping it real. No fluff, no BS. I hope that you enjoy the show.
All right, guys, welcome to another episode of the Report. Today, we are back in the studio here in downtown San Diego, and I'm back from Orlando. And we had an interesting week. We got opening day, Padres baseball. Baseball season's amongst us, and we got some Sweet 16 basketball, which is very exciting. But I'm very excited because I got a special guest today, someone who actually is responsible for getting me in the real estate game, used to partner with, actually still own some deals with together, and he's a good friend of mine. I got my man, Mike Ty. Mike, welcome to the show, brother.
Rich, it's surreal being here. Amazing job at the studio. You know, I walked this place with you like 2 years ago, and you had a vision, and it was just a blank canvas, and now it's just like, You executed, man. This place is amazing. It's really cool to be sitting in this chair and chatting with you.
Dude, I appreciate you, man. And it's funny. I talk about a story all the time. I'm like, what we did, you, Sean, and myself, working full-time as air traffic controllers in that break room. I give you all the credit for getting me into real estate because we were in the break room one day and I overheard you talking about how you just closed on a fourplex in Cleveland. And I remember it so vividly. I was like, how did you do that? It was in 2019. I was like, how did you do that? And you said, go read this blue book by Brandon Turner on real estate investing. And you said, start listening to the Bigger Pockets podcast. And I read the book and I started like just binge listening to the podcast. And next thing you know, like 6 months later, 8 months later, Sean, yourself and me, we all cashed out our 401ks and we bought that 32 unit building in Indianapolis. And the rest is history. But to think about how that all went down. And then, I mean, it was just a year and a half later after that conversation in the break room, we all quit our jobs. We all walked away from pensions, a government job with all the job security to go full-time into real estate. And so I got to give you all the credit, man.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And you know, a big takeaway from kind of that story and just chatting with you in the break room, something like I just kind of take away from it is almost like there's like a law of reciprocity, like you reciprocated and like, yeah, I provided value and told you how I bought a fourplex and things like that. And I don't know if it was by mistake, maybe you can speak on this, but you got into basically multifamily books somehow, and you sent me a breakdown of how the value add formula works, NOI. I didn't know anything about that. I was just a residential guy doing some Airbnbs and buying, you know, residential multifamilies. And then you showed me the breakdown of the math and you said, you know what? I think you're doing it wrong, Mike. I think we need to buy like something bigger here. This is the math on what the value add process looks like and the outcome that can be produced. And I was like, well, shit, it's hard to deny that, Rich. Let's do something bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I kind of brought you in the space, but then you elevated me in the space.
Mm.
So it's kind of like, you know, by providing someone with value like that, you know, you never know the value that they're going to provide back to you in the future. And I think that's kind of like my takeaway from what happened there.
Yeah. I forget the name of the book. I want to say it was by Brian something else. I can't think of the name of it, but it will come to me during this podcast and I'll drop it. We somehow Crushing It with commercial real estate with Brian something.
Brian, yeah.
And a very good book. But started reading that. And then we started reading books on multifamily millions by David Lindahl and all that sort of stuff. But it really talks about the power of like, you know, doing value add commercial real estate and really forcing the NOI growth so you can, you know, in turn force the depreciation, which is powerful.
Yeah.
And I think it was like, at some point we were all kind of like analyzing individual deals, you, Sean, and myself.
Yeah.
And somehow, one way or another, we're like, hey, what if we put our money together? And we all three of us had 401k money. We were all willing to like lose. We were all willing to risk our 401k money to like go on in this real estate thing. And I remember we got a 48 unit multifamily deal in Oklahoma City under contract before we actually pulled the trigger on the 32 unit in Indy. And I think, although we didn't buy it, there was a lot of learning lessons baked in with that deal that we could take with us to the next one. And, you know, obviously it was in a bad area. Yeah, the price was good, but there was a lot of reasons for us not to move forward on that deal. And I'm glad that we didn't, because then we wouldn't have been able to buy the 32 unit, which we did. And that ended up turning out really well. We bought it for just under 1.2 after the seller credit. And we made all the mistakes there. There was hookers, prostitution. I remember we were there for the inspection day and literally the cops showed up.
Yeah, yeah. It's never a good look, right?
Never a good look. And that thing was, I remember you walked away. We drove out after the inspection and you told Sean and I, you were like, what are we buying? Like a bag of bricks? Literally, that's what it was.
It was, yeah. It was just a mound of bricks, essentially, with some people living inside of those bricks.
Yeah. And then 24 months later, I mean, cap rates compressed. The interest rate environment was an all-time low. And I remember we were like underwriting bigger deals at that point. And we're like, dude, nothing's penciling.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the brokers was like, hey, we can get you like a pretty crazy number right now if you guys are interested in selling. And we talked about it. We're like, dude, if we can get that number, like this is a no-brainer. And so we bought it for just under 1.2. 24 months later, we ended up exiting for close to 3.2. And it was like, somebody says like around 3.1 and some change.
Yeah.
And that was our first big win in commercial real estate.
For sure.
And that was the first full cycle deal. And actually to date, that's my first full cycle deal kind of in the commercial real estate space. And yeah, it's given me a lot of confidence moving forward. I'm sure it has for you and Sean as well.
Yeah. I mean, I'm honestly really glad we didn't buy that 48 unit. You know, we weren't using investor capital, so we didn't have room to make a lot of moves. We had our own capital, which was had a ceiling on it, a low ceiling at the time. And that 32 unit was in such a good market. Like we didn't even realize how good the Indianapolis market was going to become, how great that market was going to become. I mean, that market's been on a bull run for several years now. Where, you know, kind of that hood market outside of Oklahoma City, I haven't checked on it, but I'm guessing it's not doing so hot where that market's just been thriving. Greenwood, Indiana,
yeah,
is the city, right?
Absolutely. So what did you end up doing with those proceeds from the 32 unit sale? Because we set up a TIC, a tenants in common, so we could 1031 exchange our separate ways. I went into the luxury property in Scottsdale, which is like a luxury Airbnb. What did you do with your proceeds?
Yeah, I think you and I were the only ones who did a 1031 exchange out of all the JV partners in that deal. We did the tick, the old drop and swap, is the, remember that term from the attorneys? Yeah, so we did the drop and swap. And you 1031, as you said, into Arizona. I ended up 1031ing that money into an Airbnb in Big Bear and Joshua Tree.
That's right.
Yeah.
How's that one going?
Big Bear is actually, it's doing pretty good. Honestly, out of my Airbnb portfolio, there's like eight listings. Those are my two lowest performers.
Okay.
Joshua Tree being the worst. The market has just been saturated. And like, I kind of looked back and reviewed my process before I was purchasing those. And like, I was really like kind of approaching it like a business. And I purchased two Airbnb assets that had historicals. So like, I didn't just have to go out on a limb on AirDNA and say, okay, AirDNA is saying I could make this. This is what the comp's showing. No, I actually had financials too from the owners of both those properties. And they already had permits that were transferable to me. So I was like, man, okay, so based on my underwriting, if I can just hit, or I'm gonna put some money in these Airbnbs, spruce them up a little bit, make them look nicer. I was like, even if I spruce them up and still just hit their pro forma income, I'm gonna be in pretty good shape. So then, you know, now let's look back on what happened. The Airbnb the Joshua Tree property, I actually made 20 grand more than I pro forma'd at the time. But expenses were out of control on those big luxury properties. I mean, I'm sure you know, expenses can get insane.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the expenses, I just saw my Schedule E for that property. I made $450 last year off that Joshua Tree property.
Wow.
So not very good.
Yeah, yeah.
Not a good return on equity.
Yeah.
And then Big Bear did make about 8% cash on cash. So that one, it's doing pretty good. You know, not like, not double digit Airbnb returns, mm-hmm. but, you know, it's a respectable figure. But yeah, really, I guess the takeaway is, you know, I hit my pro forma revenue numbers. I just wasn't aggressive enough in underwriting what the expenses would actually be on that property, that Joshua Tree operation.
What expenses in particular were higher than you anticipated?
Yeah, just main. So there's a yoga arena. There's a fire pit.
Arena. That's pretty sick.
Yeah,
what's that all
about? This big yoga dome with like a bunch of mats in it and everything. That whole concrete area has to be maintained and cleaned.
That's in Joshua Tree?
That's in Joshua Tree.
Dude,
yeah.
I've never been out there. Maybe we'll have to stay at your property.
I love Joshua Tree.
I want to go out there and check it out.
For sure. Just don't go in like July or August. It's like
it's too hot.
I go there with my wife sometimes. We went in like July or August because sometimes there's some open weekends then. We're like, yeah, let's just go when there's not a booking, you know?
Yeah.
But it's just so hot that you're like, I don't even want to chill by the pool right now. I got to be inside. But yeah, it has all those amenities and maintaining those amenities. And then, you know, when people break things, you gotta buy a new wicker chair that costs $400 and things like that. Pool heats. The pool heater, all of those things, just there's always something that's breaking, it seems. And maybe I just had a bad run and the next 3 years will be like pretty clean on the expenses. Time will tell. You know, it's kind of a small sample size, still just 24 months after purchase. But yeah, the expense has been really high in that property.
Yeah. I think the other thing with like buying Airbnbs in like early 22 was 2021 was a record Airbnb year for a lot of different markets because people were not traveling internationally. And there was a lot of money being printed. And so people had money, but they were traveling here locally. And so I noticed with a lot of properties that we have in our portfolio, especially ones that we manage for third-party clients, the numbers from 2021 are actually down in 22 and 23. And so it's not just Joshua Tree or Big Bear. I think it's a lot of markets in the country.
Yeah, and I think that's even exaggerated in the regional vacation markets, such as Big Bear and Joshua Tree. I'm seeing that too. Like 2021 was a record year in Big Bear and Joshua Tree because people really couldn't go internationally. So all the people in LA and Southern California with money, they're like, hey, let's just go to Joshua Tree this money. We can't go to Tokyo. Let's go to Joshua Tree. Or, you know, and that was kind of their retreat that year. So ADRs were at record highs and things like that, occupancy. And those figures have retreated, you know, since then. And people were seeing how profitable these markets were. And a lot of money was, a lot of new supply was coming online in those markets. So it's an issue of oversupply now and you know, reduced demand, I think, are the driving forces in some of those markets.
And I think like this climate, though, is weeding out a lot of the poor operators. And so I think the pendulum is kind of swinging back from a supply standpoint, and especially these more oversaturated markets. So I think over time, maybe those assets will start to perform better. I know the ones that we're operating, you know, the ones that are cookie cutter, more like just bread and butter type of properties, they're not doing the greatest in terms of Airbnb revenue right now. But the ones that are doing good are the ones that are a little bit more unique and provide a little bit more unique stays and opportunities. But it's tough right now, you know, and a lot of different asset classes. Multifamily is tough right now too, you know. It's a high interest rate environment that we're in. And, you know, I think this is where the, you know, the folks that are savvy, the folks that can get creative and are going to do well. And you guys have pivoted and you guys are doing a lot of grounded development right now. Tell me a little bit about what you guys are doing right now. Because I know last time we were all working together, you know, we were doing multifamily. We still own a couple multifamily assets together, Timber Creek Apartments and the Arbors. And over the last 18 months, you guys have made a big pivot to get into real estate development. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, obviously, you know, we were thriving in the value-add multifamily space. We love those, the deals we have over in, with you over in North Carolina. And, you know, we were underwriting deals throughout the nation, and it was so hard to find a deal that was even close to penciling. You know, it's like the numbers were so far off that I feel like every time we were sent a new deal, we're just throwing spaghetti at the wall. Like, Rich, you and I might as well put our hands in a bucket and just toss spaghetti at a wall for 2 hours instead of underwriting some of these deals. So we were trying to figure out where, like, we could find some arbitrage in the market, like, you know, where there is money to be made in real estate right now. And I think it was Sean was at a meetup and, you know, just kind of chatting up with some people at the meetup. And it was some developers that were operating more in the ADU space, which is kind of smaller development projects. And they were talking about how much it costs to build versus what they're selling for. And we're like, okay, well, sounds like there's arbitrage in that market right now. So we wanted to pivot to that market. And, you know, just like you and I did when we got in larger scale value in multifamily, it's like, okay, we've never done this before. So let's bring on a subject matter expert. You know, you and I partnered with someone who's done like has had 8,000 plus units in that market to really help us like with that acquisition phase and operational. And so we brought on, you know, a project management team, and we even have some consultants we pay for monthly that are understand the construction phases at a really high level. So we moved into that space and, you know, so we started with a smaller project, a 10 unit build in Ocean Beach. It has ocean views, really, really nice. So we're in the permitting phase on that. And then we kind of wanted to go, next step is to go bigger. So we're doing a 30 unit build over in Pacific Beach. Some nice land over there that we were able to acquire. And, you know, we're just trying to continue to scale that portfolio and probably exist in that 30 to 60 unit build size right now. So, yeah.
Dude, I love that play. To your point, I mean, it was 2021. We were underwriting all those multifamily deals. And we're like, dude, these deals are not even coming close to penciling at the pricing guidance. And these brokers would be like, yeah, Mike. Yeah, Rich. We had like 40 property tours and like 35 offers. And there's going to be multiple rounds and it's going to be a best and final. And we'd be like, what are these operators looking at? Like, what are their assumptions? And then these things would end up trading like millions over the actual pricing guidance. And, you know, unfortunately, I think a lot of those buyers are like, they're hurting right now. I was out in Houston like 5 months ago interviewing the apartment rock star. He just foreclosed on a $51 million multifamily note, class A building, bought it, no value add. And I know a lot of other operators on the multifamily side that have not been doing any distributions to investors over the past year, some as much as 2 years, no distributions. And, you know, I get it, dude. I get it. It's like you're buying at the top of the market, not a lot of value add opportunity, And then you're assuming these interest rates are going to be all-time low. You're assuming a lot of rent growth. So they're getting hurt right now. And so, I don't know, I think the opportunity right now is boutique hotels and these ground-up development deals, building in expensive neighborhoods that you guys are doing here in San Diego. So kudos to you for making that pivot. And I talked to my business coach all the time. He was on a call yesterday with our mastermind, and I was like, his name's Rick. And I was like, hey, Rick, what are like the two or three most important components or characteristics of successful business owners versus the ones that are not successful? Because he works with like hundreds of business owners. And he said, it's really three things. He said, one, know your numbers. So, you know, review your numbers, you know, if not weekly, every day. And then number two, the ability to pivot. So if you're going down a certain path and it's not working, he's like, you got to have the ability and the wherewithal to be able to pivot and be fluid. And then he said, the third one is the ability to hire good people and put the right people in the right seats. And what you're saying, the second one really resonates with me because it's the ability to pivot. And you guys did that, you know? So I don't know, man, I'm bullish on San Diego and you guys are buying in good neighborhoods here. I love this market, dude, for so many reasons. You've been here longer than me, I think.
Yeah, I was actually surprised to see Marks & Millichap release their multifamily forecast for 2024 and the top 100 markets list. Mm. And San Diego was actually number two.
No way. Which for multifamily?
Yeah. So
really?
It's rare to see a California market.
It was never that high before, huh?
No, a California market like has never been that high. And that is despite San Diego, I think their net migration last year was net negative. We lost 60,000 people. So usually when you have that kind of indicator in a market, it's not going to be high in the list. But all the other fundamentals, you know, I think are so strong that it just kind of overcomes that slight loss.
Now, I don't know, so I'm speculating, but I would argue the people that are leaving San Diego are lower income, and the ones that are migrating in have higher income. Is that probably part of the case?
I mean, I agree. Like, yeah, I know we're both speculating. Like, I don't have data on that, but I see where you're coming from, and that makes sense.
Yeah.
For sure.
You know, because if it's the ones that are leaving aren't the ones that are going to be renting these places that you're buying anyways, and the ones that are coming in could be.
For sure.
So it might have something to do with it. But that's interesting, man. Number two in the nation. I love that.
Dallas is number one right now. They've been on a bull run for a while. I mean, they have record supply coming online, and they're still number one because there's so much net positive migration flowing to that market. And you know, job growth has been insane there. So, you know, that's a big driver.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me the difference between ADU development and ground up development for these multifamily units that you're building.
Yeah, I can only speak on what I have experience with, and that's the bonus ADU program and the complete communities program. So we utilized the bonus ADU program in Ocean Beach, and we're utilizing the complete community program in Pacific Beach. And essentially, the bonus ADU program, what you'll see in practice is most people will buy a single family home. And most commonly, people will just convert a few garages and sell it like that. That's kind of a smaller play. When you're using your own money, you can do that. You know, when you're bringing in investor capital, there's not enough pop to justify doing that with investor equity. So an ADU in practice looks like a single family home with a multifamily building behind it. And there's a 1-for-1 ratio like on the bonus ADU program. So for every deed restricted unit you add, you're allowed to get one at market, essentially. So, you know, what ends up happening is about 40% of your units are deed restricted. And that's kind of the gist of the bonus ADU program, kind of at a surface level. And then the complete communities program, you don't really have to have that existing structure. You can just buy a plot of land, and it's just more traditional ground up development. There are deed restriction units that are required. But for example, I think on our 10 unit, we're going to have 4 or 5 that are deed restricted. So almost, you know, 40, 50% of them. Where on our 30 unit, we're going to have 4 that are deed restricted, you know, a much lower percentage of the units.
Can you say again exactly what does that mean when you say deed restricted?
Yeah, sorry. I should like qualify what that means, because I think that's like a San Diego term. Deed restricted is basically there's a certain income bracket we're allowed to rent to. So let's say I'm just shooting out numbers here because I don't know the brackets. I don't have them memorized. But let's say we can only rent to people that make under $50,000 a year. And then this is the max rent you're allowed to charge that individual. So that individual has to qualify. They have to demonstrate that they make under $50,000 a year. And then we have a certain rent that we're allowed, the max rent we're allowed to ask for. It does go up every year.
Okay.
But you know, it's lower than market rates.
Gotcha.
You can imagine.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the smaller percentage of deed restricted, the better, because you better get more theoretical income.
Yeah. Like okay. it definitely hurts your NOI having those deed restricted units, because you could be going, I saw a rent roll in PB right now on some low income deed restricted units. There's different tiers, which lead to different rents that you can get. But they're renting out their 2 bedrooms for $3,600. The 3 deed restrictions they have are $1,255.
Wow.
So almost a third of what the actual market rents are.
Gotcha.
So I'm happy for those people that can live in a sick community like PB at low rents. You know, maybe their kids can go to better schools and things like that. So, you know, it makes you feel good about what you're doing if you do have to do it.
Yeah. Interesting.
As a busy real estate investor or entrepreneur, time is money and first impression is everything. Every day to make it easy on myself, I wear Built Basics clothing. Whether you're a girl or guy looking for workout gear, joggers, shirts, button-downs, hats, or shoes, Built's got you covered. Super comfortable, tight in all the right places to make you look fresh and clean all the time. Visit BuiltBasics.com and use promo code SUMMERS20 to receive 20% off of your order. Again, that's BuiltBasics.com. That's BYLTBasics.com. Use promo code SUMMERS20 to receive 20% off of your order. Now back to the show.
So what's your preference? Because I know you mentioned in OB, you guys have that 10 unit ADU build, and now you're doing a bigger one, 30 units out in PB, but you're going away from the ADU model. Why is that?
Yeah, mainly due to the deed-restricted ratio that's required. And like, I'm just kind of looking down the line from a potential buyer's perspective. Like, when you're selling a house with an apartment complex behind it, so it's a little bit different than selling a nice, new, clean apartment community to someone. Because a lot of times that existing structure, that house that we're selling, you know, was built in like the 1940s. So, you know, it might be considered a new build that was built in 2024, we'll say. But there's also an aspect, a component of that property that was built, you know, 60, 70, 80 years ago. Where in complete communities, it's like, hey, here is a 2024 product. No, nothing from like 1940s, no old plumbing. Everything is brand new on this bad boy. So that, I like complete communities for that reason. And then, as you know, like a little bit of economies of scale, like, you know, it takes the same amount of work, like operationally, to have all these meetings on a 10 unit as it does a 40 unit. So like, if you have investor equity place, I'd rather just do a bigger deal. And from a time management perspective, it's going to take the same amount of my time to have meetings for a 40 unit as it is to discuss an 8-unit build, you know? So that's also a reason why I'd rather just do like larger development deals.
What kind of permitting process do you have to go through to remove the single family house and develop more multifamily there?
Yes. So the permitting process, we're in coastal right now. It's
part of the Coastal Commission?
Yeah. So there's something called the Coastal Development Permit, CDP, they call it locally. And it doesn't have to go to the state coastal. It's kind of like a city level overview. So it goes to those individuals. And they review it, and that process can take 10 to 12, maybe 14 months. They're doing much better. The city of San Diego, give them credit for this, kind of shortening the permitting timeline. So we'll see how it goes. But it used to be a lot worse.
What's the permitting timelines looks like these days in San Diego? Because I know they can be a little bit lengthy. You mentioned they're a little bit shorter now. What does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard stories. Our architect, who's been doing builds in PB since 1980s, he's probably done like 40, 50 projects there. He said he used to see it take two and a half years to get permits there. And he said now he's getting them in 10 months.
10 months? Wow,
yeah,
that's quick.
I know people who are maybe listening to your podcast through in New Jersey and stuff are like, man, I get them in New Jersey for 3 months. 10 months sucks. But for us here in San Diego, you know, that's
10 months is really
that's
good.
Something to celebrate almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how do you guys work the return profile for your investors? Because obviously there's a couple of phases, right? You're buying the lot. In PB, what was that structure? Was it a house or what do you guys buy there?
Yeah, there's two plots of land, both single family homes on them, merging the plots of land, tearing down the houses, and then kind of going vertical from there.
Gotcha.
Actually, we're going underground with parking too.
That's sick.
Because we really believe in having parking. I know the city doesn't require it. A lot of developers are building high density units with zero parking, but we don't foresee that being a successful play.
Yeah.
So we want parking. And, you know, pitching this to the investors, I thought it was going to be more of a struggle because they were used to these value add multifamily plays where, you know, first quarter that they invest with us, they're getting quarterly distributions. So they're used to that passive income coming in, where in ground up development plays, you're not seeing any money hit your bank account until the asset's built and is generating revenue. So from an LP's perspective, it's going to be about year three, 3.5 years into the project. Before you're seeing a quarterly return. We have to hold the asset for a year. We don't just build and sell right away because you get hit with short-term capital gains, you know, 40%, whatever the number is. So we hold it for a year, quarterly distributions, and then exit after that 12-month mark. So it's long-term capital gains. And then that you really make your money on the sale. You know, getting 6% returns is nice, but the big pop's at sale. So, and of course, I'd be lying if I said there wasn't more risk in these projects than value-add multifamily. So
yeah.
Any investor has to look at things on a risk-adjusted basis. So we make sure that the returns are much higher than value multifamily. The returns are higher, you know, the closer to like north of 30% average annual. But yeah, there's more risk because you have to go through permitting, construction, and everything like that. So we address those risks with higher returns.
And what is the biggest risk, in your opinion, with these projects?
My biggest concern, you know, every time there you have to take a leap of faith in your modeling, it increases risk. And like, what do I mean by leap of faith? So anytime you're doing something that you can't nail down a solid metric on, it's a leap of faith. So for example, we had really good data on how much it costs to go one story subterranean. We couldn't find solid information on like, what if we go two, what if we really want more parking, go two levels under? So we'd be taking a leap of faith there, saying, okay, like we don't know how much this costs. Let's guesstimate. When you're guesstimating, that's risk. So then your question is like, where is the risk? The areas where there's leap of faith occurring is, you know, you're trusting the city of San Diego to get these permits through on time because you're purchasing these properties on bridge debt that's 24 months. So permits are supposed to be in hand 10 to 12. So it does give you an extra year of the city kind of messing around and falling behind. But if they go longer than expected or something comes up with the city, you know, you're trusting them to get things through on time. You know, we ran it by our architect and we're like, what is the, because, you know, we have to capitalize, we have to put reserves aside because these projects bleed money from day one. Like one in PBs, 25K a month bleed. So we asked our architect, what is the worst case scenario you've ever seen to get permits? Because we want to make sure we have the capital for that. And he's like, okay, so right around 10 to 12 months, you should have permits. If someone tries to sue you guys, it's not appealable. You still have to entertain their lawsuit. He said that could add 4 to 5. I've seen it add 4 to 5 months to it. So it's like, okay, so 18 months maybe. And he goes, 18 months would be like the worst I've ever seen. So we're like, all right, let's just raise capital for 18 months to hedge our bet. So I think for me, the city, I don't trust the city of San Diego. You know how politics are
here. Oh, for sure.
So for me, the city of San Diego is the biggest risk and just local politicians.
Yeah.
Because the construction numbers we have pretty much nailed down. But it's the politicians that make me the most nervous.
So what does the debt look like when you guys bought this property? And is there, like, you go bridge to bridge? You mentioned a bridge loan in the beginning. What does that look like?
Yeah, so it's a bridge debt, which no one ever loves doing or hearing. But, you know, it's the kind of loans that you get on these products. You really have to make sure. And a lot of people were just trying to give us 12, 18 months. And we're like, no, not going to work. And eventually, you know, lenders usually kind of stick by what they offer. And they're like, these lenders that we were working with, they said, sorry, 18 is the best we can do. And they kind of circled back and you're like, you know, we'll give you guys 24 month because we told them we need that. And one thing that was in their documents that maybe is good for your listeners to keep in mind is they said, oh, it's 18 months, but you have two extensions. And I was like, okay, is it our right to, can you guys deny our extensions essentially? And we looked at the language and they can certainly deny your extension. So I think a lot of lenders will tell you like, you know, it's an 8, don't worry about it. We got extensions built in, but they can deny the extensions and people are getting burnt with that. So we're like, we need 24 months guaranteed. We can't rely on you guys. We don't know what's going to be going on in your business in 18 months. You might want the capital and just say, hey guys, capital's due. So to answer your question, sorry, I kind of like digress there. The initial loan is 24 month, no prepayment penalty, 10.125%.
That's not bad.
Yeah, 73-ish percent on the proceeds.
Okay. Loan to cost?
Loan to purchase.
Loan to purchase.
Loan to value, essentially.
Okay. Loan to value. Okay.
Yeah. So 70, it was actually 73% loan to purchase price.
Got it.
Yeah.
And so they're going to be doing all the construction costs on the back end too when you do the build?
So lenders love developers because there's three debt pieces. There's the purchase debt, the construction debt, and the perm debt at the end.
Yeah.
So when we in about 12 months, we're going to be sizing it up for construction debt. And the construction, a lot of regional banks here have a construction to perm a component to their debt. But basically, yeah, we'll be refinancing into construction debt. Construction debt is typically like 70, upwards of 80% loan to cost, and the rest you have to bring in. And, you know, the rates are right around 10% right now on this construction debt. The nice thing about it is it's not like there's a term in the construction industry, Dutch interest, where like, let's say the total construction debt needed is $9 million. In a Dutch interest scenario, you'd be paying interest from day one on the $9 million needed, even though you've only pulled $500K, say, for the construction.
Really?
So there's some, it's more the hard money guys that will hit you with Dutch interest. Uh-huh. Regional banks will just do interest based on the pool, on the draws. So even though they're going to give you $9 million, you know, you're not going to have $9 million pulled for 10 months. So you're only paying interest on what you pull, which is nice.
Right.
So, you know, you might pull $250,000, $500,000 month one, you're paying interest on that. And then it kind of accumulates with time. And, you know, there's some great people. There's some people can create some great custom underwriting models who were able to like build that in the model and everything, which is pretty cool. That kind of graduated interest payment, and then you can even get interest accrual where you can just pay all the interest on the back end. So there's no payments due until you refi, which is pretty clutch. But that comes and goes in the market.
What's the all-in cost basis for this PB project? Purchase price plus all the construction ballpark?
Yeah, I think it's around $390 per unit, believe it or not.
Okay.
So I know like people are like, wow, they cost that much to build a single apartment unit? It's like, yeah, that's what it costs in California. It's insane. Yeah.
So it's about what, 11 mil-ish?
Yeah, it's about 11 mil, 11. Yeah.
And then what's the ARV you guys are kind of factoring for that?
Yes. We do three models now in our underwriting. We do a 50th percentile outcome model, which is basically market average. And that's a 3.87 cap. And that's a sale price of about 21 mil, I want to say.
Wow.
We do a beta model, which is kind of a stress test. And that one's, I think, closer to like an 18 mil exit. And then the alpha model, which is like, hey, what if things go even better than expected? What's the real upside on this? And the alpha model is probably like around 25 mil, 26 million sales. Wow. We met with a developer recently who's just done six projects in PB. And he told us that his 20 unit just appraised for 24 million. So we're like, oh, we underwrote our 30 units appraised for 20 mil. Your 20 unit appraised for more than. So we'll see what happens. But we just go with the data we can pull on CoStar. And we just have to rely on data. And if things end up being like that alpha outcome scenario, then happy to have it.
Yeah. So how do you guys treat the after you lease up and stabilize this asset? You mentioned you got to hold it for a year to not trigger the capital gains. How do you guys treat that? Because it sounds like you could refi into perm debt, maybe return a little bit back to the investor, hold it long term. But I imagine investors not getting paid for 2 to 3 years, they probably want some sort of chunk back. So how do you kind of treat that? Will you guys look to just sell for a profit, or will you look to first refi and kind of hold it for a little bit longer?
Yeah, I mean, behind the scenes, Sean and I would love to hold this bad boy for like 7 to 10 years. It's just kind of like an asset that is pretty rare.
Yeah.
But our investors are expecting to have their money back in 5 years. That's how we pitched it. So we do have to exit. You know, we could hold it for 2 years and run up to that 5-year mark if we wanted to, if the economic conditions aren't favorable. But we do have to sell it at the 5th year mark. Now, one thing we're considering doing is something that like you and I have done on Timber Creek and Arbor, is a recapitalization event to keep it in-house. So basically take it to market, let a broker list it for sale just to make sure our current investors are getting the best possible price. And if our best offer is a price that we'd want to purchase it at, where it makes sense for us to keep it, then we would just bring in new equity to purchase out the old money. They get their payouts like someone bought it, new money gets to come in, and we get to hold the asset. And an advantage to that is we are paying, our property tax basis is way lower than a buyer. So like in development in San Diego, you pay property taxes based on the cost of purchasing the land plus the cost of the cost you spent on building.
Really?
So like, we're all in for like 11, 12 million. So we're only paying property taxes based on a 12, and the buyer's gonna be paying based on a 20 plus million dollar. So the yield is actually higher if we're able to keep it in house, the deal, and just kind of recycle the equity.
Yeah. Now, if you do sell though, I mean, you could, highest and best use of that capital is probably redeploy into a similar project, right?
Yeah.
Just from a velocity of money standpoint.
For sure.
Are you guys working on another deal now, another project? Are you guys trying to buy more?
Yeah, we're on the hunt. Our team is helping us. There's some deals we sent. Sean and I were like looking at some deals this morning. We sent in a team, asked them to reach out to the brokers and everything and kind of get some pricing guidance and things like that. And we even found some land next to a church, this big plot of land in a prime coastal location. This church has a parking lot. Then they own this other parking lot that just sits vacant. That's 14,000 square feet. So we're like, let's reach out to that church and see if they want to sell us that. And we'll tell them we can build out low-income housing for them, house some of their parishioners and things like that, whatever they want. They can retain some equity and have passive income for their church. But yes, we're kind of working on that angle too.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. What market's that one in when they were?
That one's in Pacific Beach.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's the best way to source these types of deals in the development space here in San Diego?
The best way to source them? Yeah, it's really broker-driven, and Google Earth is your friend, kind of seeing like zooming, going through areas and kind of seeing where there's land. My favorite to buy, Sean and I kind of changed our approach. We were just looking at plots of land with housing on them, but we met these developers in PB who've been around for like 30 years, and they buy land with like broken down retail, car washes, where like no one wants to buy it. You can get a little bit of a discount on it instead of buying a piece of land with like a nice house on it, where you're paying premium to have that structure there that you're not even going to use. So we've kind of pivoted, and we're scouring LoopNet and reaching out to any brokers and even just looking at Google Earth and seeing like, hey, where is the rundown retail at that's just sitting vacant and it just looks beat up that we can just tear down? Because demolition is actually pretty cheap. I was surprised by that.
Just because retail or like an old office building might trade for less than a single family house well.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. And the potential buyers you're competing with, like who's going to buy rundown retail? There's not many people interested. We're rundown multifamily. The house flippers got their eyes on it and things like that.
True.
So yeah, we're really kind of looking, trying to get creative and not just focus on plots of land with housing.
What's the latest with like some of these lots here in San Diego with like the high density stuff? Andrew Greer was on the podcast a while back and he was saying, you know, you can buy these lots here in San Diego where you can, might be able to build, you know, 40, 50, 60 units, depending on the density and all that sort of stuff. Is that something that you guys are also targeting or are you trying to stay away from that now?
Stay away from what in particular? Like the,
like buying like a single family home or whatever it is on a hill. Maybe it's got a big hill. He said like, if you have a big, like a lot of the big portion of the land is on this big grade.
Yeah.
Those are the ones where you typically build a ton of units. Are you guys interested in that kind of stuff?
I actually listened to that podcast where Andrew was on. I really wanted to listen to that one because I was excited to hear what
Andrew's great.
Yeah, I was excited to hear what Andrew had to say. And I knew you would do a great job interviewing him. But basically what Andrew was alluding to is how they calculate the size of the structure you can build is based on the square footage of the land. So I think what Andrew was saying, and I don't want to speak for him completely, is so if you're buying 20,000 square feet of land where most of it's an unusable canyon, that part that is flat at grade, you get credit for all that unusable land in your calculation and you can go vertical and build it on that flat parcel.
Got it.
I think that's what Andrew was trying to say he likes to do because building on a steep grade is super
expensive.
Yeah. And that's where we get into leap of faith. Sean and I, there's a deal out there right now that's a popular Marks and Millichap broker has on and it's in a prime location, but man, it's on a steep grade and we're trying to size up cost and all the contractors were honest, like, dude, with soil, you never freaking know. He's like, they're like, there's a lot, we can't predict costs. There's a range of outcomes. And we're like, okay, well, this is a leap of faith, right? This is risk. So let's just get rid of these steep grade projects. Now, maybe if you're experienced and it's your, if you're playing with house money, if it was my money, maybe I'd be like, let's find out. But it's not all my money that I'm using. So we're kind of sticking to flat grades right now.
Yeah, I love that, dude. I'd love to buy some more stuff here in San Diego, man. I'm bullish on this area. I always say like, San Diego is like an island, you know, because to the north, you got Camp Pendleton.
Yeah.
To the west, you got the Pacific Ocean. To the south, you got the Mexican border. And then to the east, you got mountain ranges. So from a supply standpoint, there's really not a lot of land to build on. And so you guys are taking advantage of building out inexpensive neighborhoods. I always say, you know, generally speaking, the cost and the time associated to do a build out or do a heavy renovation in a cheap market like Oklahoma City, for example, versus an area like, you know, San Diego or La Jolla, generally speaking, it's about the same, but we know we're going to create a lot more appreciation and equity growth in a hot area such as La Jolla or maybe Santa Barbara.
For sure, yeah.
And so you guys are kind of capturing that.
With real estate investing, asset protection and protecting yourself from personal liability is huge. The best way to address this is to correctly set up your LLCs and entity structure. For us at Summers Capital, we use Prime Corporate Services to set up, manage, and provide guidance for all of our entities, making it truly hands-off. If you want to learn more, visit primecorporateservices.com/richsummers to book a free call and receive a special podcast listener offer. Again, visit primecorporateservices.com/richsummers to book a free call. Now back to the show.
So what do you guys kind of foresee in the horizon for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, had you ever read the book Traction?
Yeah.
I don't know if you
read that. We use EOS here.
Okay, awesome.
Traction's a great book with Gino Wickman.
Yeah, yeah. So Sean and I are kind of following that protocol too, where you set your BHAG, you know, your big hairy goal for 10 years out, and then you have your 3 year, you got your 1 year, and then you got your quarterly and how you're going to get to that 1 year. And the 1 year has to be like, they don't want you to get too crazy with your 1 year goal. They're like, set a goal that you're guaranteed to hit, like on your 1 year, and then you get crazy with your 10 years further out. Like set more ambitious goals 10 years out. So really just for this year, we just have to do one more project like the one we did over in PB, up to a $20+ million build out. We're kind of setting our goals based on the value of the real estate we're building. We're trying to find different metrics on how to measure it. So really Sean and I this year just want to build another $20 million of real estate. That's our goal. And anything above that is just icing on the cake. So really just looking for one more project, but you know, hopefully we can do more than that.
Yeah. I love that, dude. Yeah, Traction's great, man. We use EOS here, and just from a operation standpoint, like it just makes it so much easier to run a business
for sure.
With the EOS. We do the level 10 meetings.
Okay,
but it's great. I can't imagine like operating a business without it. It's so smooth.
I love it. Yeah,
yeah.
And is your business coach? Is he like? Is he oriented around the EOS and everything, or is he kind of separate from that?
He is. Yeah, he actually implemented EOS for us. He like flew in, implemented it, but he knows all the different operating systems. I actually had him on mastermind call yesterday, just kind of going over EOS and doing a bunch of Q&A because. you know, you know better than me, man. When we were doing air traffic, it's like you get into real estate investing and you listen to these podcasts, a lot of it's all real estate investing strategy. But, you know, a big component of building a real estate business that no one really talks about is the business architecture and the structure. And so, you know, for me to be able to jump on for an hour every single week with him is huge because, you know, as you grow, it gets lonelier at the top. You know, less people can relate with the problems that you're going through, the issues that you're going through. And it's part of the game. But for me to be able to jump on with him once a week, it's
sure.
like huge to walk through what I'm going through, bounce my ideas off of and all that sort of stuff, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I saw you guys were working with Hunter Thompson in the what is it called? Raise something?
Raise Masters, yeah.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Yeah, Raise Masters. Sean and I basically wanted to improve our marketing processes, but we didn't know how to get there. Like, we know we got to do better, but like, tell us what to do. That kind of like the EOS, like, hey, I want to have systems in my business and I know it's a good thing, but I don't know how to do it. Someone just tell me what to do and I'll do it. You know, and that's the same thing we do with multifamily. Just tell me what to do. Because it's a solved industry. So we signed up with Raise Masters mainly so we could implement their marketing practices. So, you know, you purchase this mastermind, like a lot of masterminds, it comes with some curriculum and things like that. And we basically just went through the curriculum and hired some people to help us just kind of implement it in the business. And I found that really valuable, just kind of creating a funnel, creating a lead magnet. You know, that's why we wrote our eBooks and everything. From my perspective, that was the most valuable aspect for us from Hunter Thompson's program.
What's Hunter's like whole kind of strategy based around? Is it podcasts, social media, or is it more so a lot of the other principles that you alluded to?
Oh, strategy for?
Just like attracting capital, right? Because we always say, hey, you know, for me and like my mastermind, we always push like, hey, I always say the secret sauce is this. If you're trying to raise capital or you're trying to like, you know, grow a funnel of potential clients for whatever your business might be, I always say the secret sauce is monthly meetup, podcasts weekly, mm-hmm. and then daily social media content. Mm. But if you do the podcast, there's your daily social media content.
For sure,
you just clip out those clips. And the idea of those shorts, you know, it's hard to build trust with a 30-second TikTok or a 45-second Instagram reel. But if you can get people to go over to listen to your podcast, now they're listening to hours and hours of you interviewing and having conversations with people, now it starts to build trust and they start to view you as an expert in whatever field it is. So I always say the secret sauce is meetup, podcast, social media content daily. If you commit to all three of those for 12 months, it's huge. We did a lot of that early on, and you guys still have the Multifamily Takeoff, which I was actually a guest on a few weeks ago.
For sure, you crushed it.
You guys rebranded it to the Real Estate Takeoff.
Yeah.
But fuck, we started that podcast in 2019, just about the time we were buying that first commercial deal, the 32 unit in Indianapolis. And so, you know, that's paid dividends. But what does Hunter kind of base his thesis on?
Hunter is really into the fund of funds model,
okay,
which is pretty unique to Hunter. Maybe I'm saying pretty unique out of ignorance because he's the only person I've really had heard talk about it a lot. But he really relies on other capital raisers to raise capital for him. So other basically a co-GP army. So we've leaned in a lot to that. And because there's a lot of people that just want to place money, but don't want to be owner operators, you know, don't want to deal with the operational stuff. Like, hey, I got a full-time job. I'm a pharmaceutical sales rep. I'm a physician, whatever. I can raise $3 million right now and get some equity in a deal, but I don't want to be on calls every week. We're like, hey, we can definitely have an arrangement with you potentially. So we're kind of leaning into those individuals, like more co-GP fund of funds who can raise several million and partner with us. And we found a few of those people, and that's really helped us like kind of grow. And then also just getting in a lot of networking clubs with older individuals, to be honest, like more of the baby boomer generation. So we're going to a lot of more politically driven networking events here in San Diego.
Politically driven? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I guess maybe that's a poor choice of words, but this networking group, their main motive is to raise funding for certain political parties.
Okay.
And I'm a moderate, so I don't really care what your political affiliation is. I can go and chat with you about it. So I go to those events where kind of older individuals hang out that tend to have a little bit more money, especially if they're donors for politicians. So we've had success with that recently. But I'd say ultimately we're really leaning into fund of funds and just finding a co-GP army that can raise, you know, several million.
So because it's fund of funds, they don't need a broker's license because they have their own fund.
Yeah.
And they can legally raise money for other operators because they have their own fund set up.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
And you can also, so I'm sure you're aware, but like you can't compensate someone for the amount of equity they raise without a broker dealer's license. Like if I were to raise hey, Mike, can you help me with this capital raise? Like I need $1 million and then I'll give you X percent. And then I'm like, yeah, Rich, I got you. And then I'm like, oh, sorry, Rich, I only have 750K I can raise. And you're like, well, dude, I got to come down on the percent. Like that's not technically legal, but in a fund of funds, you can negotiate it based on capital raised.
Right.
Because it's, I don't completely understand the legal structure yet. I need to talk with legal counsel a little further, but that's my baseline understanding.
Got it. Yeah, I think that's my understanding as well. So the only, you cannot legally compensate someone just solely to raise capital. It's got to be like post-closing duties based on like workload. So asset management could be one, marketing the properties could be one, but it can't be solely based on, this is how I understand it. So confirm with the SEC attorney.
Yeah, for sure. Got to throw that caveat in.
Yeah. But you cannot compensate someone solely for the amount of capital they raise. However, I think the two caveats are if they have their own fund or if they have their broker license, right?
Yeah. The broker dealer's license, which I don't know many people have that. I think Hunter has it, but.
I know some folks that have like these broker licenses and they'll typically charge like 2% equity placement fee, which is not too bad, but they typically want to have conversations early on and they want to be, you know, it might take a long history of getting to know each other before they actually like bring money into your deal.
It's kind
of similar to these family offices.
Something that's
not going to happen overnight, you know?
Something that, I guess I'll give Hunter some more props, give him some more flowers here. Something I also learned from his recent conferences, like, and that I was doing a poor job of in hindsight is like, you know, you're talking to these people that you want to be potential co-GPs with you. You're just kind of having a casual conversation and you're not treating them like they're basically like an investor. So now we've kind of changed our process where we basically have a full pitch for them. We have slide decks, we have video presentations and things like that. So they can see the asset, they can see what our business core values are. And like, I think it's a better way to build trust with that individual. Cause like you said, it takes a while for them to get to know you and be comfortable placing, you know, 7-figure checks with your business. So I think that's something that we just changed that a few months ago after RaiseFest. And I've had like 3 or 4 co-GP calls that I feel like went a lot better than they previously had.
Dude, do you ever like look back and be like, fuck, I was working as an air traffic controller, like, you know, not that long ago. And then like, think about like, you know, everything you're doing now, you've got 8 short-term rentals and you got all these ground up development deals. You own a couple of large multifamily deals out in North Carolina. And, you know, your life has changed a lot over the last 5 years. Do you ever look back and just kind of appreciate it all?
Yeah, I do think like I do have those moments of reflection for sure. Like, especially like when, you know, you're driving to meetings to meet some people that you never thought you'd even be rubbing elbows with. And you're like, wow, man, you're driving your car and there's a break between songs and you just have a moment of reflection of like, wow, I can't believe I'm doing this right now. This is pretty cool, you know? So I think you have to have those moments to really appreciate, kind of enjoy the journey a little.
What's your biggest like piece of advice for someone that maybe is working a full-time W-2 and they want to be where you are today? They want to be full-time real estate investor, full-time entrepreneur. And maybe they just don't know where to start. What's your best piece of advice from?
Yeah, I think it goes back to like what you and I learned. Like, don't try to recreate the wheel to solve the industry. Like you and I, like we didn't do anything clever. We just read some books and we're like, hey, Dave Lindahl, hey, Joe Fairless, what did you guys do? Rich and I just want to do that. Just tell us what to do. Okay, Joe, you said start a podcast. Let's start a podcast. Joe, you said start a meetup. Let's start a meetup. Like we weren't creative. We just did what we were supposed to do. So I think I guess all that to say, the processes are out there and you don't have to recreate the wheel. Just, you know, you're listening to Rich's podcast right now. Rich is telling you what he did to get here. Just do what Rich did. Don't try to get too creative, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or don't try to outsmart the system. It's kind of solved already.
Yeah. It's like that whole saying. It's like, you know, if you want to lose weight, you know, what do? Move more, eat less,
yes.
Right? If you want to become a real estate investor, what do? Become a real estate investor. So it's like, you know, I think information's the secret. It's getting in the right groups, consuming the right content.
Yeah.
Learn from those that have actually done it. You know what I mean? I think that's big. And then also I think, you know, a lot of people try to get into this stuff and they're around the wrong groups. And sadly enough, it's, you know, sometimes it's friends and family members and colleagues that are telling them it's too risky. So I get talked out of a lot of this stuff. So I think what you say bodes true. Like find people that have done it. And then I would say, you know, make sure that you're listening to the right people in terms of advice. It's like, I'm not going to learn about, you know, SEC regulations from someone that's not an attorney.
For sure. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm not going to learn how to, you know, fight MMA and train from someone that's never done it before, you know? So I think in all reality, it's a lot of common sense stuff, and it's not more complicated than it needs to be.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people don't realize what's possible. And the reason I think that is, like, I'll see ads from syndicators I know, like on Facebook, you know, like kind of just 506C ads. And they're basically like, a lot of times it'll be Hunter Thompson offering his blueprint for people on how he achieved what he did. And I see the comments, and it's just people saying, laughing, like, this guy's a scam, don't do this. And sometimes I'll slide in the comments and be like, hey, I know Hunter, and what he's saying is actually true. If you guys want to learn, you know, maybe click on it instead of just mocking him. But I think there's a lot of people with that attitude, like, they don't think that it's possible. And they think it's just like a scam, or it's almost laughable to even suggest. But it's like, no, you can do it.
Yeah. And that's half of the battle. I mean, you got to, I think a lot of people that, you know, hate never comes from above.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the folks, sadly, that don't think that it's possible, you know, fuck, if you don't think it's possible, then you're never going to be in that scene ever. You know,
for sure.
First you got to believe it.
Yeah.
You know? And I think the one thing that you and I had, which was cool, is that we had the ability to take action. So, you know, we got in the books, we got into the podcasts, but push come to shove, we're like, all right, it's time to fucking take action. Where I see a lot of other folks, they join all these mastermind communities and they go to all these conferences and they read all these books and listen to podcasts, but they never actually take the leap. You know, in all reality, it's like, you know, you don't need one more book. You don't need one more podcast. Like, you need reps and you need the experience, because, you know, what you think it's going to be is going to be different once you get started. And it's true. In all reality, we're making mistakes every single week, and we pivot and we get better, you know?
I like that. I think we took this from Jake and Gino, some multifamily investors, but the whole seek to serve, pay to play kind of motto, where, like, hey, if you want to, like, get in the space, like, you can seek to serve and, like, maybe offer someone, like, rich value and, like, hey, I'll do this for you for free if I can just be around your business and learn some things. Or you pay to play and you basically join your mastermind. You know, that's basically the pay to play model. I mean, if you don't have time, it basically depends on if you have time or money, and you can learn either way.
That's true. You're going to pay with one or the other.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, time or money. But I think getting around the right groups, though, is huge. The accountability, it's huge, man. So sure. I'm curious. Well, by the way, congrats on your marriage with Yvonne.
I appreciate it, man.
Yeah, stoked for you guys.
Appreciate it.
Where did you guys get married at?
We got married in San Miguel de Allende, which is it's a really cool. So Yvonne is a very particular girl, and on a lot of aspects of things, and she wanted a certain vibe at the wedding, which, like, Tuscany kind of themed. And San Miguel de Allende is like a 16th century Spanish colony that is now, you know, obviously in Mexico. So it's got a bunch of, like, gorgeous architecture from the 16th century, you know, when Spaniards were basically colonizing that area. Old churches. We got married in this church that's like 400 years old.
What part of Mexico is this?
It's in I think the state, and I hope I'm not getting this wrong, is called Guanajuato.
Guanajuato.
Yeah.
Okay.
Are you familiar with Guanajuato?
I've been to Oaxaca, okay, but Guanajuato I have not been to.
Guanajuato
is a little bit closer to Guadalajara, right?
Guanajuato, it's pretty, it's like a 3.5-hour drive from Mexico City.
Okay.
So you fly into León Airport, which is in Guanajuato, and then you drive 1.5 hours to get to San Miguel. And it's a lot of expats there. Like, they told me it's one of the most expensive cities in Mexico because all the expats have moved there and driven up real estate values. And the local people hate it, of course. But yeah.
Dude, well, congrats, man. So I guess I'm curious for you, because I've kind of felt this way. Like, you know, when we first got into real estate, I remember buying that first deal. I was like terrified, you know, because you read the books, you listen to the podcasts, and you think it's going to work, but you don't really know until you do it. But I think my biggest takeaway now, and you've done a lot of different types of deals, you know, single family Airbnbs, multifamily, larger multifamily. Now you're doing the ground up. You've done a boutique hotel as well. And so, I don't know, for me, I'm like, fuck, like, all this real estate, you know, first you think about all the things that could go wrong, but after doing it all, I'm like, you know, yes, there's going to be things that go wrong, but you always figure it out. Like, the number is always, as long as you, like, try, and as long as you, like, are somewhat, like, competent, like, you're going to figure it out, like, no matter what happens, and shit's going to have happened that you can't even, like, plan for.
Yeah.
But, like, what's your biggest takeaway doing all these different deals? And, you know, some are great, some are okay, but, like, I don't know, like, what's your biggest takeaway there?
Yeah, like let's say, like, you know, when we have presentations and we have a pro forma in the pitch deck, no one can ever hit their pro forma. You're either going to be above or below it, right? And something is going to go wrong in that pro forma that's for the worse, and something's going to go better, right? Like maybe our construction costs are 3% higher than expected, but then the interest rate is also far lower. So I think you make so many hedges knowing that something is going to go wrong, but then something's going to go better than expected too. And hopefully at the end, they kind of balance each other out. And that's kind of my takeaway from like the pro forma perspective of kind of modeling out real estate.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. You're never going to hit spot on. And
to exactly hit your pro forma is pretty insane. But
I mean, at the end of the day, it's risk, right? Nothing's guaranteed. You know, you can fall short of these projections, but at the same token, you can exceed on these projections. But the good thing is with commercial real estate, unlike businesses, you know, investing in all these startups, it's like those startups, a lot of them go to zero. But commercial real estate, you're buying good assets in good locations. You know, over time, as long as you got runway and you let inflation do its thing, it's really hard to lose. I mean, think about this building that we're sitting in right now recording. This is a 130-year-old building.
Really?
That was built for the purpose of doing industrial. They used to manufacture stuff in this building.
Yeah.
And you see the arches over here, all original stuff. All the brick is original. But think 130 years later, this building is still bringing in income as an office space. You know? Can't say that about most startups, you know? So yeah, I don't know. I think there's a lot of different avenues and vehicles to place your money. But I think from a risk-adjusted return basis, commercial real estate is probably one of the safest ones out there.
Yeah, I love real estate just like you do. I mean, probably 95% of my capital is in real estate.
Where do you put the other five?
S&P 500 index.
Do you? Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know you're still messing with the stocks, man.
Yeah, I put a little bit in the S&P 500 index. That's like the best bet in Wall Street. I don't really mess with individual stocks.
Yeah. What's your biggest takeaway with cashing out the 401?
Great idea.
I love
that. Yeah. I think you proposed the idea to me and told me what that looked like, and definitely don't regret it. And I'm sure you don't either.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was really the only seed money I had.
Yeah.
And had I not done that, I'd probably still be working air traffic, you know? And, I mean, I'm glad we bought Breeza. You know,
that used a balanced transfer card to pay for my mentor. Didn't even have money for a mentor.
Really?
Used a balanced transfer card.
Oh, with Tony Azar?
Yeah. I didn't have the money for that. But it's like, all right, well, how can I get some money? Oh, there's something called a balanced transfer card. Let me look up what this is. Borrowed the money, and then later got an acquisition fee, paid off the balanced transfer card, and kept the rest. So it worked out.
Yeah.
Yeah, plus just all like weird things like that.
Plus all the equity that you'll get with that deal.
For sure, yeah.
But yeah, it's crazy. Anyways, my man, hey, always a pleasure catching up, dude. We'll have to run it again at some point. And dude, wishing you and Sean nothing but the best moving forward. I'm a big fan of everything you guys are doing.
Appreciate it, bud.
Yep. He's Mike Ty. I'm Rich Summers. Listeners, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you in the next one.
Peace.